Chapter 5. How We Give and Receive. A Sex-Positive Mindset. So, you're mapping your emotional floor plans, learning to identify which emotional space you're in and what puts you into that space, how you get out, and where you are when you get to the other side. All of this so that you and your partner can help each other co-create a context that makes it easy for your brains to access pleasure. Especially lust pleasure. Let's enhance the floor plans and your context creation with a sex-positive mindset. For me, the term sex-positive doesn't mean that all sex is positive, which it certainly isn't, or that everyone should like, want, and have sex. It means that everyone gets to choose how and when they touch and are touched, and everyone gets to decide how they feel about their body. This basic bodily autonomy is the foundation of good, great, and spectacular sex. Hence, sex positive. A sex positive mindset acknowledges that each of us is cultivating our sexuality in a potentially toxic environment and with potentially harmful experiences in our past. Sex positivity fosters each person's sense of entitlement to basic bodily autonomy. You deserve full choice at all times about how and when you are touched. So does every partner with whom you share touch. You deserve to choose how you feel about your body, accepting or critical, loving or grieving. And so does every partner with whom you share touch. Confidence and joy. When people ask me what I do for work, I say, I'm a sex educator. I teach people to live with confidence and joy inside their bodies. Then they ask me if they're normal, and I tell them how very normal they are. But I wish they would ask me what I mean when I say confidence and joy, because when you replace, am I normal, with, am I confident and joyful, your whole outlook on your sexuality shifts. Confidence and joy are the foundations of a sex-positive mindset. Confidence is knowing what's true, about our bodies, our sexualities, our life histories, our cultures, our partners, and our partnerships. It's knowing what's true about the bodies we lust in, the world we live in, and the relationships we love in. Knowing what's true, even when it's not what we were taught should be true. Even when it's not what we wish were true. You're listening to this book to learn what's true, and this kind of education is definitely part of knowing what is true. Read books and watch videos and listen to podcasts and consume all the media you trust. But that's not the most important part of how to know what's true. Another important part of how we learn what's true about something as complex as sex is through social learning, observing others, talking to others about their experiences and our own. You can do this on social media, but it's so much more impactful when you can do it face to face. There's nothing like talking to people you know and like in real life. You learn by talking with others, as well as by reading and listening to trustworthy media sources. But even talking with others isn't the most important way to learn what's true. The most important way to learn what's true is listen to yourself, your body, your heart, your mind, your soul, your internal experience. Listen, believe, and trust. This is easier for some people than it is for others. I, for example, have a very noisy internal experience that's difficult to ignore. It draws my attention away from the external world and pulls my attention toward my own body. Yet my identical twin sister, Amelia, is clinically bad at listening to her body. After years of struggling with her health, she was diagnosed with alexithymia, which is basically an inability to notice or understand her own internal experience. She doesn't notice when her foot falls asleep if she sits in one position for too long. She has to think for several minutes to understand whether that sensation in her abdomen means she's hungry or she has menstrual cramps, or she has digestive distress. For folks whose experiences are more similar to my sister's, she's written a Listen to Your Body, The Basics Guide as an appendix in our burnout workbook. So those are three ways to learn more about what is true. But in my experience, there are three kinds of true things that are difficult to know. One, true things that aren't what you were taught should be true, or things you wish weren't true. If you didn't grow up knowing there are breaks, or that responsive desire is normal, common, and a typical characteristic of a sexual connection that lasts decades, you might find yourself wishing you didn't have breaks, or that spontaneous desire was easy for you. It can be difficult to let go of facts that contradict your image of what an ideal sex life looks like. Many self-help books, from home decluttering guides to professional success manuals, ask you to envision your ideal life as a way to establish a goal and a why for all the changes you're going to make. I can't do that here because your image of an ideal sex life has almost certainly been shaped by a bunch of mean-spirited cultural lies. Your ideal may involve having a body or a partner that looks and acts a certain way. It may include some behaviors and not others, without reference to which behaviors bring you pleasure. It may include all kinds of rights and wrongs. How many of those are something you actively chose, rather than something that was handed to you as an ideal? Writer and sex educator Steph O'Terry wrote about her experience of learning about responsive desire and discovering the freedom that comes with knowing and loving what's true in her book, Dirty Word, How a Sex Writer Reclaimed Her Sexuality. She said to her partner, "Just because I don't want to have sex as often as you do, it doesn't mean that there's something wrong with me. It's completely normal for me not to be in the mood all the time." That was before the COVID-19 pandemic. When I talked to Steph in 2022, she told me that her revelation stuck with her for a while. She and her partner had both gotten a more concrete sense of what activated each other's accelerators and what hit each other's brakes, and things got better as they collaborated. But then, with the increased stress, exhaustion, and depression of the pandemic, her guilt reemerged. She started putting pressure on herself, even though her husband did not pressure her. That's the thing about the weeds in the garden. They can grow back if you don't keep on pulling them. And sometimes we get so busy with other things, we forget to keep weeding. She finally talked to her husband about it, and it turned out he was genuinely okay with not having sex. The pandemic was affecting him, too. And it was such a relief to know they were both normal, and his loss of desire didn't mean anything except that pandemics can make sex seem less important and less worth having. Two, true things that other people tell you are not true. Suppose you learn that your desire style is primarily responsive, and you tell your partner, "Hey, wow, I learned this cool thing. I don't have low desire, I have responsive desire." And they reply, "No, that's wrong. Desire happens out of the blue, and if you don't feel it out of the blue, then it's not desire." They're contradicting what your own learning, your own internal experience, and your own innate wisdom are telling you is true. Best case scenario, maybe they're doing it out of their own lack of knowledge. But also, maybe they're doing it out of a sense of entitlement to your performance of the sexual script you both thought was true for the longest time. Let's assume a best case scenario where they're simply re-explaining their beliefs on the assumption that what they've always been taught is true is actually true. This is a great opportunity to share empathy and knowledge at the same time. Like, "That's what I thought too, but I listened to this book by this person with a PhD and multiple best-selling books and a TED Talk and stuff, and she explained it in a way that made me understand my own experience completely differently." You may even add, "Can I play you that part of the book?" In an alternative scenario, where the person feels threatened by the potential withdrawal of something they feel entitled to, it's a little messier because you'll need to help them manage any sense of loss they may feel in letting go of their existing script. Some communication tips for this situation. 1. Emphasize how much better your sexual connection will be when you're not trying to fight against your sexuality, you're working with it. 2. Explain how much better you feel about your sexuality now that you know your experience is normal, and reinforce that if your partner, too, can know that you're normal and not broken, and thus embrace your sexuality as it is, it'll help release that judgment that was hitting the brakes, and you'll be so much freer to enjoy sex. 3. Allow space for any feelings of sadness, grief, or loss that may accompany your partner's letting go of your sexuality as they believed it to be. Only by letting go of the false idea can they open up space for what's true. The third true thing that's difficult to know is true is a true thing that is new since the last time you learned a lot. This one happened to me in the form of a new medical diagnosis that no doctor or book or online advice ever mentioned might impact my sex life. I have a balance disorder that makes me so sensitive to motion that an elevator can make me motion sick. In a car, I must be the driver. I can't be the passenger. Well, while attending a plenary talk on sex and disability at a sex education conference, I suddenly realized I must be the driver. I can't be the passenger. And that includes during sex. The uncontrolled motion of sex could sometimes be enough to trigger my sensitivity, but if I could adapt the way I had sex, I could avoid the triggering motion and thus avoid any potential for discomfort. When I joyfully explained my insight to my spouse, he was immediately delighted that I had figured out a way to make our connection more enjoyable. This kind of discovery will happen over and over during a sexual connection that lasts decades. Your bodies will change, your relationship with this partner will change, your relationships with others will change, and all of these changes will create new things that are true. When you stay open to discovering new truths, you stay open to confident, joyful sex. Some new insights about what's true can bring risk of loss and potential for discomfort along with the joy. Coming out as gay, lesbian, bi, pan, ace, aero, kinky, poly, trans, agender, or any of the other wide variety of genders and sexualities humans experience requires you to defy much of the world's constantly expressed opinions about who you are supposed to be. Sometimes we may internalize those messages so deeply that even we can't believe anything else could be true of ourselves. And sometimes we've worked so hard to accept one identity that the idea that it could change is heartbreaking to us and sometimes to our partners and even to our communities because they too feel invested in our truth. When the truth changes or your insight changes, everyone involved needs to mourn for the truth that is now lost so that they have space for what's true now. Knowing what's true does not oblige anyone to share their truths with anyone else. In an ideal world, we get to choose when, how, and with whom we explore our identities, our pleasures, and the many other domains of sexuality that may or may not be what we were told they should be, or even what we once wished they were. You can be confident of what's true without being in a place, emotionally or socially, where you can comfortably live your truth out loud. That doesn't make it any less true or valid. I wish for you a place where you can share what you choose, when you choose, in a context of safety, love, and welcoming. Confidence is knowing what is true. And joy is the hard part. Joy is loving what's true about our bodies, our sexualities, our life histories, our cultures, our partners, and our partnerships. It's loving what's true about the bodies we lust in, the world we live in, and the relationships we love in. Loving what is true even when it's not what we were taught should be true, even when it's not what we wish were true. It may seem like a contradiction that the path to the sexuality you long for begins with loving the sexuality you have right now as it is. If you don't love the sexuality you have right now as it is, then you'll be so busy criticizing, judging, shaming, rejecting, and worrying about your sexuality, noticing everything you wish were different, that you won't have time, attention, or energy left to try something new. So here is my super secret slash not at all secret because it was the title of chapter 2, so please tell everyone you know, shortcut for accessing joy. When you turn away from all the various cultural lies, you can replace them with just 2 words of instruction. Center pleasure. Start from scratch. Assume everything you were taught about sex for the first 2 decades of your life is incorrect, and start again with pleasure as your only measure of sexual well-being. But let's not kid each other. Loving what's true is harder than knowing what's true for at least 3 reasons. Reason 1, joy is hard because we were lied to. How can we love our orgasms if they take too long or require the wrong kind of stimulation or happen less frequently than they're supposed to? How can we love our genitals when we've absorbed so many messages that they're the wrong size, the wrong shape, the wrong shade, the wrong smell? How can we love our sexual desire when it appears to have been missing in action for weeks or months or years or always? How can we love our bodies when our bodies are so far from what everyone in the world is telling us a body is supposed to be? I hear you asking, how, Emily, can I love what's true when what's true is that I'm broken or flawed or afraid or a failure? Answer, you can love what's true because every notion that you are broken or flawed or that your body is scary or can't heal or that there's any such thing as sexual failure is a lie. You've been lied to your whole life. Details on that in chapters 9 and 10. But you already know some of the lies, like the desire imperative and shame around pleasure. It's a simple answer that I know is not always easy. When you feel yourself losing contact with joy, return to this reality. You were lied to. You are lovable. Reason 2. Joy is hard because you have to detox from the lies. When you accept that you've been lied to, you'll feel some feelings about the fact that you've been living with lies for decades. You may feel angry. You may feel rage at a world that deceived you for your whole life. You may feel hurt. You may feel sadness, grief. None of us will ever be the person we were taught we should be. Letting go of that phantom self, we will grieve. Then the lies will tell us we are failures, that we're giving up, and we are giving up. We're not giving up on ourselves, though. We're giving up on the lie. These are difficult feelings. One of the things I say pretty much anytime anyone will listen to me is feelings are tunnels. You have to go through the darkness to get to the light at the end. But getting to the light isn't always easy. Joy is the hard part. Joy is big. It's powerful. And it's scary. If joy is too big a step right now, especially if your body endures difficult-to-love experiences like chronic pain, loving what's true can still work if you can just reduce the degree to which you actively hate, criticize, or judge what's true. Neutral noticing is great. Often, neutral noticing is all you need. Confidence and joy are the tools that make talking about sex with your partner not just easier than having sex, but potentially fun. Because you can love what's true without judgment or shame. Which brings me to one last thing about joy. Something I hear a lot is comparison is the thief of joy, and that's wrong. Compare all you want. Learn more about what's true in the world and feel free to compare your experience to other people's and go, ooh, that's interesting. Comparison can be neutral noticing. Children compare their body parts out of curiosity. It's healthy and normal to want to learn more about what's true. Curious comparison is no thief. Indeed, it can enhance joy. When people say comparison is the thief of joy, what they usually mean is not the comparison itself, but the judgment that can arise from a comparison. Judgment is the real thief of joy. When you compare and merely notice similarities and differences, you can enhance your understanding of what's true about you and the rest of the world, which increases your confidence. When you compare with positive curiosity, you can even enhance your love of what's true, which increases joy. But when you compare not just to notice similarities and differences, but to assess and decide what is good and what is bad, who is right and who is wrong, that is the opposite of loving what is true. Judgment is deciding that some of the things that are true are bad and wrong and unworthy of equal existence. Judgment is the anti-joy, whether it's self-judgment or judging others. Normal. This confidence and joy stuff might be what other people need, you might be thinking, but I just want to be normal. Not broken or a freak or a failure. I hear that. Literally, I hear it all the time. Some variation on am I normal is the most common question I'm asked. But what does normal even mean? And why does anyone, everyone, care whether they are normal? I think so many people are worried about being normal because we're led to believe falsely that we exist on a continuum from broken to normal to perfect. We're taught that sexual perfection is the goal, yet no one has to ask me, am I perfect? Because we all already know we're not perfect. We have decades of life experience that filled our heads with self-critical voices constantly telling us just how imperfect we are. So we aim for normal. In the face of endless messages telling us we're broken, we're inadequate, we're doing it wrong, try again, no, that's wrong too, and if you don't fix it, you'll never, ever be perfect. There's nothing wrong with wanting to be perfect. Perfect is just a code word for acceptable, even admirable, and above all, safe from anyone's contempt. Like, once you're perfect, no one can judge you. Oh, friend, anyone can judge you anytime, no matter how hard you work to conform to their standard. Again, there's nothing wrong with wanting to be perfect. We all want to be free from the judgment of others. Remember, comparison isn't the thief of joy. Judgment is. That includes self-judgment. If you want to be perfect, I have good news. You are already perfect. The linear continuum of broken to normal to perfect is a lie. Sex is not a linear progression from broken to normal to perfect. Instead, it's a cycle of woundedness to healing. Back to the wound, back to healing, and around again. What wound? Maybe the idea of woundedness doesn't feel like your experience, but if you are trying to change your sexuality to be normal or to be perfect, that longing to change, to fix your sexuality, is itself a wound. The wound is the lies you were taught all through your life about bodies, sex, gender, love, and safety. It's all the self-criticism you've inflicted on yourself for not matching what you were taught you're supposed to be. Much more on this in chapters 9 and 10. It's all the punishment you've survived for not matching other people's expectations, not being man enough or ladylike, not being a strong, independent woman, not being a sensitive enough man, not having spontaneous desire, wanting sex too much, having the wrong body, not working hard enough to change your body, you slob, working too much on your body, you narcissist, being a prude, being a slut, being a virgin, having too many partners. However you have lived in your body as a sexual person, there have been voices screaming that you're doing it wrong. With a sex-positive mindset, we turn toward what's true with love. We heal the parts of ourselves wounded by all those lies about the ways we're broken. And we turn toward what's true about our partners with love, too. With our non-judgment and love, we help heal the parts of our partners that were wounded by all the lies about the ways they, too, are supposedly broken. In this cycle of woundedness to healing, we become stronger in the places we were hurt. This isn't my original idea. Haven't we all heard by now that our cracks are where the light gets in? Everyone has said it in their own way, from 13th century Sufi poet Rumi, "The wound is the place where the light enters you," to Groucho Marx, "Blessed are the cracked, for they shall let in the light." Heck, isn't the moral of every comic book movie that our greatest strength often derives from our greatest wound? I think when people want to be perfect lovers, they want to be uncracked, unwounded, not crazy, so impressively ideal that they become unleavable. And I have not met one person who has never been broken or wounded. This natural, healthy oscillation from woundedness to healing allows you to transform the places you've been hurt into the places where you find your greatest strength. The wound of the woundedness to healing cycle isn't just from trauma, abuse, or neglect. More on those in Chapter 7. It's also all the damage done by cultural messages insisting that you're broken. They're so relentless. By their sheer persistence, they actually injure or even break a sexuality that would otherwise be whole. The very idea of normal has been used as a weapon against you your whole life. Even without explicitly traumatic experiences, you have been injured by the expectation of normal. Which, wait, now we have to figure out what normal even means. One definition of normal is something like conforms to the expected cultural narrative. If I asked you to describe normal sex, you probably have some ideas about who is having it, what behaviors they engage in, how long it lasts, how it feels, how often they do it. In fact, your questions about normal might stem from your sense that your own experience differs from this cultural script of how sex should be. And let's acknowledge right now, you vary from the cultural script of how sex should be. That doesn't mean there's anything wrong with you. It's the script that's wrong. I'll say that again, just so it's clear. Where you vary from the cultural script, it's the script that's wrong, not you. Oh, you'd like a more scientific definition of normal. Okay. Here's what normal means in the research. If 1,000 people answer a multiple choice question on a survey, the scientists add together everyone's answers to the question and divide that total by the number of people whose answers were included. That's the measure of central tendency, or more precisely, the mean. In that context, normal would include any response within 2 standard deviations of the measure of central tendency. Obviously, when you wonder if something in your sex life is normal, you aren't wondering, am I within 2 standard deviations of the measure of central tendency? That's why sciencey answers to sex questions are often unsatisfying and unhelpful. For example, perhaps you wonder what the normal frequency of sex between couples is in a long-term relationship, according to science. Answer: who cares? What in the world do the people who participated in that research have to do with you and your sex life? Nothing, y'all. Bupkis. Zipperoo. I don't answer questions like, how often does the average couple have sex? Because it's impossible to hear the answer and not judge yourself against it. If you have sex more often than normal, you feel a certain way. And if you have sex less often, you feel a different way. It's reflexive. You can't help it. But again, what does the sexual frequency of the couples who participated in that research have to do with you, your relationship, or this season in your life? Ziltroid. Diddly squat. It's the same reason I don't answer the question, but how often do you have sex, Emily? Or how long was your longest dry spell? People ask these questions in search of details to help them assess their own sexual frequency or dry spell. What if I tell you we went 7 years without having any sex? What if I tell you the longest dry spell was a week? You would have feelings about those two answers because you are judging my answers against your own sex life and against the cultural script's normal and aspirational answers. As I said earlier, judgment is the thief of joy. So when people ask me any version of the question, am I normal? The answer is yes. Oh, you're pretty sure there are exceptions and you want a precise definition? Okay. Normal sex is any erotic contact among peers during which A, everyone involved is glad to be there and free to leave whenever they choose with no unwanted consequences, and B, no one experiences unwanted pain. Glad to be there doesn't have to mean I can't wait. It can be as simple as, hey, buddy, nice to see ya. Free to leave with no unwanted consequences means not just no physical consequences, but no emotional consequences. No guilt or shaming, no emotional bribery, but if you loved me, you would. No coercion of any kind, not even, aw, come on. If your partner pouts and complains if you want to stop doing something, that might be commonplace, but it's not part of my definition of normal sex. If you're the partner who's glad to be there and your partner wants to change or stop what you're doing together, you may experience uncomfortable feelings like disappointment, frustration, or fear of rejection. Those feelings are normal, and when your partner is ready, you can talk about them. But isn't it so much better to feel some frustration and worry rather than to find out your partner wasn't glad to be there and was only going along with it because they didn't want to hurt your feelings? Hurt feelings are so much easier to cope with, so much easier to heal than the hurt of having sex when one of you is not glad to be there. And no unwanted pain. If you're experiencing pain you enjoy, do you, friend. Whether you're being spanked, whipped, clipped with clothespins, pierced, stretched, or having your hair pulled, if you enjoy it in the context of mutual consent, go for it. But if it hurts and you dislike it, that sensation doesn't belong in normal sex. There are a number of medical conditions that can cause pain with sex, and your best course of action is to find a great medical provider. I say this knowing that it often takes multiple tries, especially for women of color and women with disabilities, to find a doc who will take our pain seriously. But unwanted pain includes unwanted emotional pain, too. If your eroticism includes the experience of being, say, humiliated, scolded, punished, or ignored, and you and your partner are participating with mutual consent in that experience, awesome. As the kids say, I'm loving that journey for you. But if you feel humiliated, scolded, punished, or ignored by someone you're connecting with erotically, and you didn't choose that dynamic together, That's not part of my definition of normal. So, when you find yourself worried if you're normal, now you have a way to tell. But just as people aren't asking if they're within two standard deviations of the central tendency when they ask me, am I normal, they also aren't asking me, is my sex fully consensual and free of unwanted pain? So what are people asking when they ask, am I normal? Is this normal? Is my partner normal? And why does it seem to matter so much? After all, you're not listening to a sex book in order to be a normal lover, right? If your partner told you after lovemaking, that was really normal sex, would you feel complimented? In my experience, when people ask if they're normal, they mean, am I broken? Am I doing it wrong? Am I adequate? Do I belong within the human community, or am I a freak and a failure? Without knowing anything about you, I can already answer those questions. No. No. Yes. And you absolutely belong within the human community. None of these questions can be answered by learning about other people's sex lives and then judging yourself in comparison to them. As I say again and again, everywhere I go, we are all made of the same parts, just organized in different ways. And all of those ways are beautiful, normal, and, dare I say, perfect. Abandon the idea of normal as a gateway to perfect. Normal, by its usual definitions, is a dead end. Replace it with the cycle. Here in the real world of woundedness to healing, perfect is the cycle itself. Anywhere you are in the process, you are in perfection. You're not satisfied with that. That's fine. You want a definition for perfect sex, as in the best sex? Okay, I'll give you a definition. The best sex, perfect sex, happens when everyone involved is not only glad to be there and free to leave with no unwanted consequences, i.e. normal sex, but also when everyone involved turns toward their own and everyone else's sexuality as it is right now, in the moment, with confidence, joy, and calm, warm curiosity. Curiosity is the subject of Chapter 7. For example, suppose a partner with a penis wants an erection and isn't getting an erection. Both of you turn toward that soft penis and toward all the feelings you each have about it with confidence, joy, and calm, warm curiosity, loving what is true. You enjoy the pleasurable experiences you can have with a soft penis, whether that means playing with a soft penis or directing your shared attention elsewhere. That's perfect sex, regardless of whether or not an erection happens. Another example. Suppose you want to have an orgasm, and you've been stimulating yourself off and on for something over an hour, and you haven't got there despite high levels of pleasure and arousal. Turn toward that pleasure and arousal with confidence and joy. Love what's true. Perfect sex, regardless of whether orgasm happens. Perfection lies not in solving every problem permanently. That will never happen. Because it's a cycle, you will always be moving through woundedness and back to healing and back to woundedness, growing with each cycle, even as life circumstances change and affect how you grow and heal. Perfection means you are always growing, always healing, always changing, always confronting new ways to grow. Mike and Kendra. Mike's recognition of the woundedness to healing cycle started out as a conversation in the kitchen while Kendra got dinner ready. The kids were with their grandparents and due home any minute, but obviously Mike and Kendra seized the opportunity to have a conversation. But as they began to cover the same ground they had covered at least 50 times before, Kendra's patience wore thin. He wanted her to want sex. She was sorry, but it wasn't that easy. Mike didn't resent that exactly, but, well, ha ha, if he couldn't have passion, he would take what he could get, he told Kendra for the 51st time with a heavy sigh and eye roll. Allow me to draw some foreshadowing attention to the heavy sigh and eye roll. It will turn out to be the key to the whole thing. His exact words were, "I'd rather have sex when you're not super into it than not have any sex at all." Spoken like, "Ha ha, aren't men absurd with how much sex matters to us? Aren't we silly?" He was making fun of himself, making light of his unfulfilled 4-year longing. But that's when Kendra lost patience. She turned away from her grated carrots, raised her voice, and said, "Are you seriously telling me that you would rather have sex with me when I'm not into it than have no sex at all?" Nonplussed by her strong reaction, Mike said, "Why? It's not, and how many women before me did you have sex with when they weren't really into it?" She was glaring at him with a mix of rage and disgust. Mike was silent. His face was cold and his hands were shaking. At last he said, "You know that's not what I meant." "No, I don't. I think that's exactly what you meant because it's the words you said. I'd rather have sex when you're not super into it than not have any sex at all. That's what you said." She turned away from him, back to her cutting board. She grated carrots for the salad. "I was joking. I was trying to lighten the mood." "Look how well that worked," she shouted as she grated. "The mood is so light right now." "Why is this such a big deal for you?" he said. She dropped her knife and turned back to him. "Are you listening to what you're saying? Are you hearing yourself? You're telling me you can enjoy sex with someone who's just going through the motions. You're telling me that it's worth your time and energy to have sex with somebody who's writing a grocery list in her head the whole time. Really? You like that?" "I don't like it. I just..." "Shit." Mike stood with his hands on his hips and turned his face to the ceiling to keep back tears. "Shit." "What?" Kendra snapped. "I hear what you're saying, but..." "Oh, but! But what?" "But I would never actually like sex if you weren't fully agreeing. What I was feeling is, I just need to feel I'm accepted. I'm acceptable. And sometimes, with you, yeah, I'll take what I can get and be grateful." On other days, Kendra might have melted into compassion and tried to make him feel better, assure him that he is accepted and acceptable. Right now, though, she was in no mood to coddle his feelings. She said, "You can't get that from any of the other things we do together." "I can, but sex is like, it's ultra-concentrated acceptance. It's a big dose of, you're not disgusting or ridiculous, actually." See that? The real feeling underlying Mike's longing was to feel that his sexual desires, his sexual body, were lovable rather than contemptible. Relenting just a little, Kendra acknowledged, "And here's me saying that your ha-ha super funny joke about having sex with someone who isn't super stoked to be there is both disgusting and ridiculous." "Yeah," he said. He sniffed and opened the fridge door to browse for a snack. "Eat a carrot if you're hungry. Dinner's almost ready," Kendra told Mike, then added, "Sorry, you're not one of the kids. Eat whatever you want." They were silent for a few minutes as Mike ate a slice of carrot, allowing the tension to dissipate a bit, before Kendra said, "Is there really no midpoint between me treating you like sex with you is gross and me treating you like sex with you is the thing I want more than anything in the world?" They heard her mom's car pull into the driveway, signaling the return of the kids. And they let it go for the time being. These kinds of conversations are complicated and have lots of layers. How everyone feels right now, how everyone feels about the history of the situation, how everyone feels about the various potential solutions. And you may be thinking, all they need to do is X, or why can't they see that Y? They can't see what you or I see because they're in it. But some things were already going really well with their communication. What most impresses me about Mike in this conversation is that he got to the vulnerable, hurt part of himself without Kendra having to act like his therapist or his mother. She didn't have to be sweet and help him along. He felt the painful source of his longing, even when she was frustrated. He didn't yet know what to do with it, but he recognized at last that his desire for Kendra's desire was not about her. It was about a deep, old wound inflicted on his sexuality by a culture that doesn't teach men how to receive love. Mike wanted passion. He wanted spark. But under that, he wanted to be received by his long-term sex partner as not repulsive. He would have to heal from that wound before he could fully let go of his wish for Kendra's spontaneous desire. And he would have to let go of that in order to open himself up to the project of co-creating a context that prioritized pleasure over any specific experience of desire. I know some of you will be feeling joyful, free, and delighted by this alternative way of thinking about sexuality, not as a standard you're supposed to try to meet, but as a personal exploration with no good or bad, no right or wrong apart from consent and no unwanted pain. But others may be feeling frustrated, disappointed, dissatisfied, or annoyed. You want concrete, practical strategies for solving problems that are damaging one of the most important relationships in your life. And here I am talking about confidence and joy. Maybe it sounds frivolous, but in fact, this is the most concrete and practical advice I've given so far in this book. The others are just information. This one is transformation. Unlearn the lie of linear progression from broken to normal to perfect and replace it with the woundedness to healing cycle. Change what the words normal and perfect mean to you. The research and my own personal experience, as well as the reports from many, many students, all agree that loving what's true and flowing through the cycle is how you build a great sexual connection that lasts across many years. The elements of a sex-positive mindset require an ongoing challenge to old patterns that no longer serve us. If what you've been wanting is to match some ideal you have about what sex is supposed to be, what you really need is to be who you truly are. Don't aim for change right now. Aim to know and love what's true right now. Pleasure will grow from that. I know it's not necessarily intuitive. If you don't believe me, that's fine. Try it anyway. Try it for 6 months. Collaborate with a partner. Give it your all. And if it doesn't improve your sex life, email me and tell me about it. In the meantime, we'll end with some great questions to ask yourself and your partner. Chapter 5, TLDR. 1. Confidence and joy are essential components of a sex-positive mindset. Confidence is knowing what's true about your body, sexuality, relationship, life history, and culture. Joy is the hard part. It's loving what's true about your body, sexuality, relationship, life history, and culture, even if it's not what you were taught should be true, even if it's not what you wish were true. 2. Many of us grow up believing that sex exists on a linear progression from broken to normal to perfect. It doesn't. Instead, sex exists within a cycle of woundedness to healing, and none of us is ever finished. We are all always moving through the cycle. 3. Normal sex is any erotic contact among peers where everyone involved is glad to be there and free to leave with zero unwanted consequences, including emotional consequences, and where no one experiences unwanted pain, either physical or emotional. 4. Perfect sex is normal sex where everyone turns toward whatever is happening with confidence, knowing what's true, joy, loving what's true, and calm, warm curiosity. Some good questions. What was I taught normal sex is? Who has it? What do they do? How often? Where? And why? What was I taught were the consequences of failing to be sexually normal? In what ways is my sexuality not what I was taught it should be? How is my sexuality like my partner's? How is it different? Which differences are easy to notice neutrally? And which differences activate a sense of judgment that one of us is wrong or right, broken or normal?